Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us how they reacted to the Fed pausing on hiking interest rates. Ross checks out the U.S. and Canadian dollars, crude, and gold. He also has a special offer for our listeners. Veteran trader Victor Adair gives us his take on whether interest rates will continue to rise, the outlook for the U.S. dollar, and whether inflation is in for the long haul. Author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble, John Rubino, comments on why oil and uranium are trading higher, the impact of inflation, and whether AI is the solution to labor shortages. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. Find him on Twitter, now X, at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be back, Jim.
Anything big on the stock markets this week?
Well, you know, how about the S&P closing at its lowest level in 3 months? Now, you know, there was a lot of excitement into the summer, into July. We put in a sort of a tested high in August, but no follow-through. And the big names, the Amazons, the Nvidias, the Microsofts, just rolling over. And, you know, here we are, that time of year, September, when markets tend to, if they're going to have some weakness, this is the most opportune time for that to happen. You're between earnings seasons. There's not a lot to really help the market out. And at this point, you know, we've this erosion that we've been seeing in particular this week, you had, you know, the S&P's down 1%, the Dow's down 2%, and then, you know, the NASDAQ, which had been the high flyer, is down 3% on the week. So it's an across-the-board move. And We've been seeing the advanced decline line eroding away, and so it's not unusual to be seeing this kind of a break. Ideally, between here and maybe the end of the month, the early part of October, if we can get oversold, then there should be some pretty good opportunities. Going to be looking for maybe the S&P, which is trading around the, let's call it 4320. If that gets around 4,200, it's going to be pretty darn interesting down there. And with the erosion we've been having in the bond market, now fueled once again by the Fed talking about high rates for, you know, extended periods of time here, you've got new highs as far as the yields are concerned. And both the, you know, when you look out on the curve, anything from the 2 years all the way up to the tens, we're at the highest rates that we've seen in a number of years. So, you know, a 10-year bond in the U.S., government bond at 4.3%. You got a even a 2-year, you're getting 5%. So you take a look at the stock market versus what you could get for fixed income, and, you know, there are people who are now, you know, putting some money away and saying, hey, why take the risk in the equity market right now when you can get a decent return on bonds?
What's going on with crude?
Crude is, you know, got up to this $90 level and change, and good overbought levels up there. Trend is still up, overextended for the last week or 10 days. Still thinking that you could have a pretty good correction. The commitment of traders numbers, where we take a look at the speculative and the commercials, those positions now, we've had 2 weeks where the parameters that we look at for overbought or oversold in each of the categories are now into important levels where you would expect to see a decent correction. So, you know, here we are at 90. Wouldn't be at all surprised that you're looking at something in the sort of $84 to $85 range as far as a correction is concerned. And if you take a look at the stocks, things like the XLE or the XEG ETFs, they topped out a week and a half ago. Couldn't do much this week at all. Sort of an erosion process down about 0.5% on the week on those stocks. So, you know, just maybe be patient as far as the energies are concerned. The uraniums, that's been the real flyer as far as the energy complex is concerned. And the big names like Cameco have also found some trouble up here and look like they're ready for decent-sized corrections as well.
What's going on with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
U.S. dollar just continues to push up here through that 90 or that 105 level, which has been you know, a reasonable target on the upside. But from you know the perspective here, support would be anticipated on anything back around 104, and cyclically the this rally out of July is a little long in the tooth right now. So if September ended up with a bit of a correction, I wouldn't be at all surprised there. The Canadian dollar stuck in a trading range. We know we got oversold a couple of weeks ago when we were down at the 73 level. The upside target was going to be in the 74.5 range. We've seen that at this point. You're probably ready for now just a bit of a choppy affair in here. The currencies that sort of stood out recently were the British pound. It was up around 131 U.S., and the COT numbers, commodity traders numbers, flashed a huge sell signal up there, and we're now down at 122 in a span of a month and a half. And the other currency that has been strong, probably one of the strongest major ones in the world, was the Mexican peso. And that one also looking a bit tired up in here and ready for a good-sized correction. That'll help those of us who like to go down to Mexico for the a break in the middle of the winter.
Any action in the precious metals?
Midweek, tried to have a really nice attempt at a breakout, and the work that I've got here would suggest that we're long in the tooth on this consolidation, and still need to see a definitive close through the 1960 level to show that gold is breaking out. In the meantime, seasonality here would be holding us sort of under pressure until we get towards the end of November, and you probably look for good strength starting in December. But if there's a premature breakout on here, I would go with it on the upside without a doubt, because we've been sitting around for so many years now where we've had three attempts at the let's call it the 2050 to 2080 level for resistance. Once it punches through that, yeah, I'm thinking that you're looking at something over $3,000 on that next leg up. But you need patience. It's not going to happen overnight.
What's cooking in your anything else file?
Well, you know, we're holding on here to a 25% reduction on the subscriptions through the end of this month. The idea being that this is a month of usually of opportunities. And if we can get down into some of these good oversold levels, then we'll be looking for the stocks which are starting to show some buoyancy. You know, you can have some good sell-offs and tested lows, and if those tested lows look reasonable, it's a nice way to come out and take the trade into year-end.
And Ross, that special offer will be on your website?
It's on the website, which is chartsandmarkets.com.
Ross, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X, formerly Twitter, at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Victor Adair, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in British Columbia. He's speaking to us from Parksville on Vancouver Island. Victor's still very active in the markets. Check out his website, victoradair.ca. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Always a pleasure to talk with you, Jim. Thank you.
There were several central bank meetings this past week in different countries, but the federal, can you explain what the FOMC is?
The Federal Open Market Committee, but you could just say FOMC.
Right. The FOMC meeting rocked the markets. What happened there? What did the Fed do, and what's the market's reactions to all these central banks deciding we're not going to hike rates this time?
Well, that is kind of a $64 question, but going into the meeting, and it was a two-day meeting, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then at the end of the meeting, 11 o'clock in the morning, West Coast time, 2 o'clock in Washington or New York time, the Fed says, okay, here's the deal. And they did not raise interest rates, and that's what the market had been expecting. But as the announcement and then subsequently the press conference that the chairman had, he made it, I think, perfectly clear, to use that expression, that the Fed is not contemplating cutting interest rates anytime soon, and might raise rates some more. And the market really has been waiting for, I don't know, months for the Fed to stop raising rates or start cutting rates, and then that would be, in some respects, sort of a green light special to buy stocks. So the stock market was disappointed. It fell. Interest rates, which have been trending higher here, depending on your time frame, certainly for the past 3 years or so, went higher still, and the U.S. dollar was higher again. And, those were sort of the main beneficiaries, I guess, of the Fed making it clear, in other words, that they would maintain these interest rates or go higher for longer than the market had previously assumed. That was really the message they had to deliver, and that's how the market took it.
You've almost always been a U.S. dollar bull over the last couple of years, and with the U.S. dollar index up for 10 consecutive weeks, is there a big smile on your face?
Well, I tell you what, there's one of my old chestnuts that I have is that the currency markets will trend and go further than you think makes any sense, and then go some more before they turn almost on a dime and go the other way. That's just been sort of my experience of trading currencies for about 50 years. They are a different cap than, you know, the equity market or the interest rate market. Of course, all of them are dependent or interlinked, let's say, with each other. But yeah, the U.S. dollar has been trending higher. Now, over the past 2 years, I've generally been bullish. I know we had the U.S. dollar hit a 20-year high last fall, I guess it was late September, just about a year ago. And then it fell from there. And let's say through maybe the first part of this year, the euro currency was rising. And if the euro was going up, a lot of other currencies kind of go along with that relative to the U.S. dollar. As a matter of fact, on my website, I frequently refer to the euro as the anti-dollar because people that, if they are bearish the U.S. dollar, sort of the first thing they look to buy would be the euro. This is within the domain of currencies, okay? Just leave it at that. And one of the reasons the euro was going up was that the European Central Bank finally, you know, got off the whatever and started to raise interest rates. They had maintained negative interest rates for a long time and started to move interest rates higher. And at that time, you know, the market thinking was like, you know, here comes the dark horse. So they're raising interest rates. The Fed's probably going to slow down and the ECB will pass them. So, you know, you want to buy euro. Well, that petered out about 10 weeks ago. And since then, as you mentioned, you know, the U.S. dollar has closed higher for 10 consecutive weeks. I mean, I will use terms like American exceptionalism on my website where over many, many years, I have noted and repeated that capital will come to America for safety and opportunity. So if you've got a war going on in one part of the world, you know, capital will come here. Or if everybody's nervous that, you know, the economies are going to hell in a handbasket, you know, the U.S. dollar will get bid. On the opportunity side, I mean, one of the classics was in the late 1990s, when they had a tech industry, let's call it a nascent tech industry, and a lot of dot-com specials in the United States, but not elsewhere. You know, capital just flooded to America to participate in markets that they couldn't find in other places. So, yeah, capital moves, and in the currency markets in particular, the trends seem to extend, and then they do turn on a dime. But right now, a smile on my face. No, despite what I know about currency trading, I mean, I caught a good part of this rally early, but lately I was thinking, oh, I think this U.S. dollar on a short-term time frame is overdone to keep going up. So I've actually been kicking myself here a little bit about not being long the U.S. dollar the past 2 weeks.
Interest rates have been climbing for the past 3 years with short-term American rates around a 20-year high. Do you think they're going to keep climbing?
You know, that is the $64 question in the world of financial products. I mean, I'm going to do this kind of ad hoc, but if we just kind of take a list of things to consider, something I've said for a long time is that zero interest rates caused people who should have just been savers to try to become traders or investors. Now that we've got interest rates back up to, call it 5%, you know, which, I mean, 20 years ago we wouldn't have thought 5% was any big deal, but after a decade of zero, 5 looks pretty good. And we've seen a lot of capital flow into money market funds. I think in America we've got about $5.5 trillion in money market funds, and the money market funds invest in short-term paper, you know, usually government paper, that sort of thing. Very safe, or let's say certainly a lot less volatile than the stock market. So I think a lot of capital has flowed into those markets, and people maybe are grateful that they don't have to take a chance on buying a stock, but they can just buy like a GIC equivalent or a T-bill or something like that. Interest rates at the long end, the 10-year got to what some people call the 5,000-year low. I don't know, but let's just say the lowest level in a long time. At about 0.5% was the yield on a 10-year treasury in August of 2020. Now we're at about 4.5%, so rates have gone up 4% since that period of time. But to get to your question, will interest rates keep going up? Well, why have they been going up? I think cause and effect, but certainly, you know, the Fed has seen inflation. They've said we're going to fight inflation. One of the ways they're going to do that is to raise interest rates, perhaps thinking that if they get interest rates high enough, that will act as a retardant or as a brake on the economy. You know, unemployment will go up and, you know, inflationary pressures will go down. Sorry for being so coarse about it, but I mean, it seems that's been the general picture. So I guess really what we have to ask is, will inflation go down? And if inflation doesn't go down, then the central banks probably won't lower interest rates, and the interest rates people will have to deal with will stay at these levels or go higher. So I'm not trying to avoid the question here, but maybe we can talk about inflation just a bit later and my thoughts on that.
The S&P index nearly returned to all-time highs at the end of July, but has fallen about 5% since then. Is the decline simply due to rising interest rates?
That's a big factor. Something that I think doesn't get much coverage in the press because it's a bit obtuse is what we call positioning. If a piece of news comes out, and let's call it it's bad news, and it hits a market, but the market sort of takes the bad news in stride and keeps going higher, then we say, you know, that's actually very bullish, because a market that'll deal with bad news and keeps going higher is, you know, is fundamentally bullish. With the stock market here, we'd had quite a run from the lows of last October. For instance, if we just look at the NASDAQ, which contains, you know, the Magnificent Seven, as we talk about them, the very big cap leading tech stocks, that index at the end of July or middle of July exactly was up about 50% for the year to date. And that is the strongest first 7 months of the year the NASDAQ has ever had, to give you some idea as to what a strong rally that was. And clearly, you know, people were, if you were a professional money manager, for instance, and you were managing other people's money, if you didn't own things like Apple and Nvidia and Microsoft and Tesla and so on, you know, you'd get some tough questions from the people that you're managing money for, and they might even just say the hell with you and move their money to somebody else. So there's a lot of career risk in making sure you've got the right stuff. And just like, for instance, if you've got the same stuff in your portfolio that all the other money managers around have got, and the market goes down, you know, you can say, well, yeah, you know, I didn't underperform the market. It just, you know, the market went down. So, you know, career risk is a big deal. Now, when I say positioning, there's people, you know, the old-fashioned idea about a guy that's going to go through the financials of a company and go out and kick the tires at the local factory and so on and so on, and he's going to decide this is a good company to buy. Then there's a whole new generation of people that just buy on momentum or other technical things, or even with passive investing, they just keep buying all the time, regardless of what the price is. They just have this idea that if you average into the stock market over a long period of time, you're destined to make money. So it seemed as though, as we got into the middle of July, that positioning was pretty bullish. In other words, people who were inclined to be buyers had already bought. And then, you know, you get to a point where, like the Wile E. Coyote, you look around and you say, whoops, we ran off the edge of the cliff here. And for no real big reason, you know, the market goes down a bit. And as it goes down, that generates some sell signals for some of these technical programs that are buy when it goes up, sell when it goes down. So that exacerbates the ebb and flow of the market. So certainly, rising interest rates were a good excuse, but there is also other things, like people are thinking, well, maybe there's going to be a recession and blah, blah, blah. But for me, from my trading perspective, I am more interested in the positioning or the psychology of the market than, you know, what an academic economist might determine when he looks at a particular statistic that comes out.
Yeah, I love, somebody once said the definition of an economist is they've never met an average person, but they've had one described to them.
Well, I've got some friends that are economists, so they're nice people. They have a training to do it that way, and that worked. Let's go to one of my favorite market sayings. I've met lots of people and certainly read about a lot more who've had enormous success trading in the markets. And one of the things I've noticed is that they are as different from one another as chalk is from cheese. So the people who have been successful are people who find a way of participating in the market that suits them. So if you're an economist and the stuff you, the way you look at the market and the way you participate in the market from your training, if that works for you, God bless you. You know, carry on.
Yeah, it's like the people who go to the horse race track. Some look at all the different sheets, the jockey records, the horses, and others just pick their favorite color on the jockey, and they're about the same success rate. Now, gold has dropped about $200 from the highs it made in May. You frequently explain that a strong U.S. dollar and rising interest rates are toxic for gold. Is that going to remain the case?
Well, if the U.S. dollar continues to be firm and interest rates continue to be firm or rise in either case, yeah, that continues to be a toxic environment for gold. Now, having said that, and by the way, that high that we had in May that we dropped $200 from, that high was an all-time high in the futures markets, and it lasted all of a couple of minutes. I remember, I think it was May the 4th, and the actual details of what made that happen at the time, but we had a pop in the markets, and so we're down from there. I think gold has held up remarkably well, given the strength of the dollar, and particularly given how much interest rates have gone up. And I look at a lot of historical charts. Martin Murenbeel, the world-famous gold analyst, a personal friend of mine for 30 years, I've been reading his weekly letter, and he is one of those economist friends of mine. If gold had continued to track real interest rates the way it had, let's say, from 2018 or so until 2021-22, we'd be at least a couple of hundred dollars lower than where we are right now. Now, if you may remember, if I haven't told you this before, I look at correlations between markets a lot. I believe all markets are interconnected at some level. So when a correlation such as gold and real interest rates break down, you say, now why is that? Why is that breaking down? Why is gold staying higher than it should, given what, you know, the correlation it has with real interest rates? And just to be a little off topic here, the color on this would be, I remember reading somewhere that astronomers knew there had to be another planet further out in the solar system. In other words, they knew Pluto had to be out there, but they just hadn't found it yet. And the reason they knew it was because of how the other planets went around the sun. So you have to, in this example with gold, you got to think there's something else out there that has changed the gold market. And certainly last year, it seemed as though the stalking horse or the dark horse, whatever, was central bank buying. That central banks stepped up and bought like a lot more gold last year than they have in, you know, I don't know, 20 years or something like that. So when you see a correlation that goes haywire, you have to think there's something else here that we're not considering when we make a decision about or have an opinion about where the gold price should be. So, yes, strong U.S. dollar, rising interest rates, toxic environment for gold. But I have been surprised that it's held up as well as it has, and I think that is because this other thing, the Pluto, as it were, which was central bank buying, has come in and supported the market.
And we won't get into the debate, is Pluto a planet or not?
Oh, okay, good, let's not.
Yeah, but it is big enough to have moons. WTI crude oil hit a 13-month high this week, trading above $93. What are your thoughts on crude?
Well, let's see. I mean, we've had OPEC Plus, as they call it, that's the original OPEC group with Russia, have as a group, but most particularly Russia and Saudi, have cut their production, reduced production, and have extended the period of time that they'll keep production down. So that's definitely been a positive. I believe, and I'm not going to say this is a fact, but I believe we have a consumption of crude oil in the United States at an all-time high. Production of crude oil in the United States is, you know, at an all-time high or within a whisker. We're just short of 13 million barrels a day of crude being produced in the United States, and yet they still have to import more to, I think it's 21 million barrels a day they're using, so do the math, it's about, they still have to import about 8 million barrels a day. What do I think about crude? I mean, it's been a strong market. It's had a great run. I don't know, we're up about 40% or something like that from the lows we had back in May. The rising energy costs are certainly a major impact on inflation, because it just, you know, you need energy for everything, right? To move things and to keep things warm or cold or what have you. So I guess that the key, maybe the question there is, you know, where does it go from here? I've traded it a couple of times from the short side this week. I thought, you know, above $92 WTI was maybe a bit aggressive. I made money on one of those trades, lost some money on the other, and believe me, I was trading rather small size because I thought it was kind of a risky trade. There's a couple of things in the world that I don't like to be short over the weekend, and gold and crude oil are on that list, because if somebody presses a button somewhere, you know, like all hell breaks loose, you know, we've just seen, for instance, when, you know, the Russians invaded the Ukraine, gold and crude oil just skyrocketed, and if you're on the wrong side of that trade, you're going to lose a lot of money in a hurry. So I'm more comfortable really trading currencies, interest rates, and stock, and I will trade WTI or whatever derivative like that from time to time, but that's I don't feel like I've got a lot of expertise there. Certainly I keep an eye on the market. It's one of the key components out there, but I really don't have any idea whether we're going higher or lower. I know Joseph Schachter, a good friend of mine. I'll be at his conference over in Calgary, I guess, in about 3 weeks. Joseph, I think on the short term, believes crude is pricey here at $92. But I know on a, you know, on a couple of year kind of time frame, he's looking for much higher prices there. And I'll defer to him. He's forgotten more about crude oil than I've ever learned.
On your weekly trading desk notes on your website, victoradair.ca, you've been writing about how people are trying to catch up to rising prices, and their attempts to catch up will sustain inflation a lot longer than we think it'll go. Could you care to elaborate on that?
Yeah, that's been kind of a pet project of mine. I was going to say pet peeve, but it's not a peeve. I remember the inflationary period of the 70s quite clearly, and I don't say it has to be exactly like that again, but I remember back then, by the way, we also had a lot more people in the workforce were in unions then than is the case now. But it just seemed like every time you turned around, somebody was on strike, you know, and it just was relentless until at some point you thought, gee, you know, maybe everybody's going to be in strike. Nothing will move. I mean, I remember being in Italy in the very late 60s or thereabouts, 70, and there was no traffic on the freeways. You know, the gas stations were all closed, and so on. People were on strike. I think that people understand that the prices of things they buy, things they have to buy or that they buy, are going up way more than, you know, what the CPI inflation says. And they are going to do what they can to be able to continue to buy the things they need or want. Now, in some cases, people just borrow more money. You know, we've seen credit card balances in the United States have now gone through or above $1 trillion. It seems like a big number. I don't know, these days we throw that around pretty loosely. But another way to catch up will be to go on strike if you're in a union. If the pilots from one airline get such and such for a raise, then the other guys are, you know, just automatically going to get it. The UAW that's the United Auto Workers, have been out, I think, is it 2 weeks now or is it just a week? I'm forgetting. But come this next week, I think we're going to see that strike start to spread to more plants. Now, some people point to what they claim to be outrageous demands on the part of the union in terms of monster increases, work less hours, get paid more, and without going into all the details, one of the details I honestly have to tell you I saw that was astonishing was that they wanted a defined benefits pension plan, which means, you know, they're going to get a set amount of money in the future as opposed to sort of taking your chances as to what the pension fund managers do in the market. No corporation wants that, wide open liability going into the future. There's an organization, I think it's a private health organization, Kaiser, in the States, have got a lot of employees that they're looking at going on strike. I just think we're going to see more and more strikes. And the more strikes we see and the more wage increases that we get, you know, that kind of feeds on itself because it leads to a thing called wage price inflation. And I'm just of the view, I guess, that with everything, whether it's, you know, labor prices, labor costs going up, energy costs going up, then this whole thought among people that they need to keep up is going to sustain inflation above the 2% level that the central banks are targeting. So what does that look like? Perhaps at some point the central banks like just sort of quietly agree, okay, well, we'll go to 3% or 4% or whatever. I also think there is no political consensus or constituency to do what is maybe necessary to get inflation down. That there is, you know, this, we've kind of had the central banks in a way pass the baton to the government, so fiscal stimulus has come along to sustain things, and now it seems a lot of people in government believe that they can just spend as much money as they want. Doesn't matter how much they're bringing in taxes, they can just spend a hell of a lot more than that, and they are. And when there's more money in circulation, then the value of things you can buy with money goes up. So I think we are going to have higher inflation. And I guess, Jimmy, if I can go back to where you'd asked me earlier, what do I think about interest rates? If we're going to have higher inflation, we are going to have higher interest rates. I think that those are just going to go together. I mean, why would I lend somebody money at 5% if I think inflation is going to be 8%, for instance, you know, pick a number like that. So, yeah, this has been... you know, and I'm not an economist, not somebody can explain this to you with models and say, you know, look at this chart and all. It is just my sense, remembering my days in the 60s and 70s when inflation was like that and you had everybody trying to catch up, and it just kind of makes sense to me that people know inflation is bigger than what the CPI says it is, and they're going to do what they can to make more money or get more money to get the stuff they want. So... Where does this all end? I don't know. You know, it doesn't look like it's a healthy path to be on, but it's the one we're on anyway.
Yeah, back in the 70s and 80s, we used to get a cost of living bonus every 3 months because inflation was so rampant.
Yeah, and it probably didn't really amount to all that much compared to the real world.
It was just taxed away.
Yeah, there you go.
Now, on your trading desk notes, you have a thing called Thoughts on Trading where you talk about risk management and so on. So what's your latest thought on trading?
Well, you know, I was just talking about some of the things I was doing this week. And I'll lead off by saying I lost money this week. You know, usually when you have a guy on the show, he's going to tell you what he did this week and what a genius he was. One of my favorite questions for traders and for myself is, you know, what are you going to do when you're wrong? And people that have heard me deliver speeches at conferences or something will probably have heard this before, but I just think it's a beautiful capsule. I was a commodities broker for 45 years or something, And let me tell you, I saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people lose millions and millions and millions of dollars. I did. And I thought, what is the common denominator here? And certainly, from my perspective, and I mean, I saw the tickets, I listened to the people on the phone and that sort of thing, people did not like to take a loss. You know, they bought something and it's not going up, it's going down, and one of the things would be, well, let's just give it a few more days. I'm sure it's going to turn around. You know, so to me, there's nothing wrong with being wrong except staying wrong. And so anytime I go into a market, if I'm going to buy something or sell something, I know where I'm going to get out, and it's going to be pretty damn quick. It's no waiting around, and I'll put open stops in the market. You know, so if in the middle of the night something happens on the other side of the world while I'm asleep, you know, I'm out of the market. I'm out of it with a loss. But to me, taking losses is just absolutely something you have to do, and you might as well take small losses rather than take big ones. And so, I mean, you could argue if you would have stayed with it longer, it would have turned around, you know. Okay, well, that brings me to another axiom, and that is you have to keep, or you got to try, and it's really difficult to keep the time frame of your trading in sync with the time frame of your analysis. For instance, I just got done saying, I think we're going to have higher interest rates, you know, because I think inflation's going to be higher. I mean, that's what I think. But that doesn't mean I'm going to go out and get short the bond market like as soon as I hang up the phone. You know, I got to pick my spot to do that. And, by the way, on a shorter-term time frame, and I going into the weekend here on Friday, I bought the bond market, even though it looked like it was been getting clobbered the past few days. I think it's due for a bounce. So my trading time frame there is very short-term, even though I've got a more bearish view on bonds long-term. So there's a couple of things. Those are the sort of things I write about. I guess the purpose of my website, Jimmy, is I try to write about what I see in the markets, what I'm doing. I keep it as honest and as real as I can, with the hope that folks that come and read my website, and you know, you got Google Analytics, I can see there's people all over the world that read my website, and that's kind of fun. But I hope, you know, what I write will give them something to think about, or it'll in some way will help them be a better trader, or at least manage their emotions over trading.
Was Kenny Rogers' song "The Gambler" right? Know when to hold him, know when to throw him, know when to walk away.
I love that song. It is so good. Yeah, you got to know when to hold them. You got to know when to fold them. And that is just I think at one time on my blog, I even had a link to where you could go on YouTube and listen to that song. No, that's a perfect song.
Victor, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Jim, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for having me on.
My guest has been Victor Adair. Check out his website, victoradair.ca. Coming up, John Rubino, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website dollarcollapse.com. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Hey, Jim. Good to be back.
John, oil and uranium just got new handles, $90 and $60 respectively. Their charts look parabolic. What's going on there?
Well, whatever it is, it's nice. Anybody who owns oil stocks or uranium stocks is pretty happy right now. two fairly separate dynamics there. One is with oil, OPEC has cut back on production a little bit lately. Demand has been strong. Supply hasn't really kept up with it. And the U.S., you know, no matter what issue you look at, there's some moronic thing that the U.S. is doing to be involved in it. And we basically ran down our strategic petroleum reserve in order to get through the last election so that the incumbents could win. And now we have to buy back the oil to replenish the strategic reserve, and that's adding demand to a market that's already pretty tight. So oil just bumped up into the $90 range in U.S. dollars per barrel. So nice run. Uranium is a different and actually much more solid story, because basically the world ran screaming from nuclear power over the last couple of decades, realized recently that that was a bad idea, and now they're piling back into nuclear by building new plants and bringing old plants out of mothball. And so the demand for uranium is going up faster than mine production is increasing. So it's a tighter and tighter market that is leading to higher and higher prices. And there could be a lot of room to run from here. You know, it's already gone from the 20s and 30s up to the 60s, it could easily double from here. So that's a very, very nice situation in uranium right now.
Could a parabolic oil price rise cause more people to buy EVs, thereby igniting lagging electric vehicle sales?
Yeah, maybe. To the extent that oil and gasoline prices go up, that's good for the competition, which is electric vehicles, but they've got problems of their own. There are shortages of the materials that go into batteries, or supply chain issues in any event, and that's making it hard to keep the prices as low as they are for electric vehicles, which is not that low at all. They're still pretty expensive, so they need to get much better at what they do. In other words, to be able to lower their prices dramatically for pure market forces to lead to electric cars being the dominant technology on the road. And it's unlikely in the short run. So these government plans of, 50% electric by 2030, that's not going to happen. So there's, which plays back into the oil story. There's still going to be quite a bit of demand for oil going forward, and that's likely to support prices in that market. And electric cars will do fine. You know, we're trending in that direction, but it's not going to be nearly as fast as maybe seemed likely a few years ago.
Are there any deflationary trends offsetting higher oil prices and higher wages?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of deflationary trends. I mean, you know, we haven't talked about wages yet, but that's a very big deal right now. Wage inflation is something that's going to be headline news in the next few years, because unions, especially in the U.S., have figured out that they can strike and they can win, and they end up with big pay packages. The airlines have given their pilots double-digit wage increases. UPS drivers now, in some cases, make $170,000 a year, and the UAW, the United Auto Workers Union, is on strike in the U.S., and however it plays out, they're going to end up with a pretty decent wage increase. You know, they've already rejected 20% over 4 years, I think. So I think they're going to get closer to 10% a year over 4 years, plus some pension stuff. And that's going to lead the Fed to worry about wage inflation. And it's leading them to, in their last meeting last week, they ended up saying that they were going to stay higher for longer than most of the marketplace expects. And part of that is wage inflation fears. And that's what's smacking the stock market around this week. We're going to have a big down market for, the week of the 22nd. I think Friday is the 22nd. Yeah. So that week, stocks in the U.S. are going to be down. And a big part of that reason is higher interest rates brought about by wage inflation. None of that's going away anytime soon.
Gold just hit an all-time high in Japanese yen, and it's in a bull market against most other currencies. Why is it just treading water in the U.S. and Canada?
Because our currencies are a little stronger relative to other currencies. For instance, the yen, Japanese government finances are basically the worst of any major country that's ever existed. I mean, they owe more per capita than anybody ever. And they've kept interest rates at extremely low levels in order to make that debt manageable. And that's leading to the yen declining pretty dramatically lately. And gold goes up in an environment of a declining currency. So gold is behaving exactly the way it ought to in Japan, which is to say it's going up versus the yen. And gold is up against the U.S. dollar and the Canadian dollar, just not as much. Gold spiked in the U.S. in like 2020, and it's been treading water ever since, although it's still up over longer periods of time. That's also a temporary thing because, you know, even if the U.S. dollar is strong versus some other currencies, it's still weak in terms of purchasing power. We still got, after double-digit inflation in 2022, we're still looking at 4% or 5% inflation this year, and that's the official number. The real number is somewhat higher, as always. So that's the kind of environment where gold will eventually go up, and it's just a matter of time.
Do you think the BRICS will ever be able to bring in a gold-backed currency in their war against the U.S. dollar?
There's a lot of technical reasons that make it very hard, but the BRICS, you know, it's really up to them. I mean, they're a bunch of dictatorships mostly, which makes it hard for them to get along and cooperate and trust each other. But they also have a common enemy in the U.S., legitimately, because we're the bad guys in the world right now. And it's completely possible that the U.S., being as much of a predator as it is, will give those guys the motivation to actually work together to do some things to allow them to bypass the dollar. One of them could be a trade currency that they set up that's backed by gold or defined by gold or something, and they use that to trade. Other things could be bilateral trade deals where they just use each other's currencies. They're already doing that. It's not a perfect system, but it's I think a lot of them consider it to be superior to having to go out and buy dollars and then use those dollars to buy oil or whatever else. So they're doing that already. And one other thing might be, you know, because they control so much of the world's commodities, to use their ability to cooperate in terms of production and sale of a lot of commodities to raise the prices of those commodities. And that would make them richer and the U.S. poorer. So we could see all of that happening and some kind of a gold-backed trade currency might be part of the mix at some point.
In China, they're having a real estate meltdown with Evergrande and Country Garden. Could that real estate crisis hit us on this side of the Pacific?
Yeah, we got a lot of problems in our real estate market, too. Commercial real estate, I mean, it's not as bad as China. China blew up the biggest real estate bubble in human history. Something like 74% of household net worth in China is tied up in real estate. So that makes it much more serious for them. But we've got commercial real estate that is in some cases imploding, especially office buildings in the U.S. And we've got a housing market that looks like it's rolling over because mortgage rates are up in the mid 7% range right now in the U.S., which is making it really hard to buy a house and also hard to sell a house. If you've got a 3% mortgage on your current house, it's crazy to sell that house and then go out and try to buy another house if you have to take out another mortgage because your monthly payments on your new house will be twice as high as they would have been if you'd bought the house 3 years ago with a 2.5% mortgage. So the housing market is kind of frozen at the moment, but there's a bunch of new inventory coming. One is Airbnb. You know, tons of people went out and bought multiple Airbnb units and just put them on the market as rentals. They're not making nearly as much money as they were supposed to. And just generally, Airbnb management is harder than anybody thought it was going to be. And prices in general of housing is starting to kind of roll over just a little bit in the U.S. And that's going to spook a lot of these Airbnb guys who have unprofitable units into selling. So that inventory is going to come on the market. And then you've got the predatory private equity guys who were going around buying entire neighborhoods of houses and then just renting them out at really high prices. Well, they're in the same boat as the Airbnb guys. The market has peaked. It turns out that they bought a lot of their houses at the very top of a housing bubble. House prices are going to start to fall, and that's going to spook a lot of these private equity guys into selling because they don't care. You know, they're just shuffling assets around. So they will bail out, and you know, they'll sell those neighborhoods after they bought those neighborhoods. And all that inventory is going to cause house prices to tank in the coming year. That's my theory of the case for housing, and I think it's very possibly going to turn out to be true sometime in 2024.
Any good ideas on how to protect yourself from this rampant inflation?
Obviously, gold and silver are things that you want to own when your currency is being inflated away by moronic governments. That's been true for 3,000 years. And it's as true today as it ever was. You know, witness Japan, like you said, any kind of other real asset, like energy assets are doing very well as the dollar depreciates. So oil companies, uranium companies, for reasons we've already talked about, natural gas pipelines, farmland, things like that are going to be just excellent investments, really good defensive investments in particular in what's coming. And then, you know, keep some powder dry because all of these rental houses being dumped onto the market might create some bargains at some point. And it wouldn't be a bad thing to maybe own a couple of rental units at the bottom of the next cycle. So be prepared for that too because, you know, the mistakes that were made by private equity and by Airbnb people could come back to benefit regular people who keep some cash on hand big time in the next few years.
Do you think inflation is purely a money supply oversupply thing, or is it supply chain or a very complex matter where there are no simple solutions?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, supply chain problems are an issue, and they will stay an issue because we've kind of abandoned globalization. And good riddance, you know, because it was destroying the middle class, at least in the United States, having all our factory jobs shipped to China and places like that. And we're bringing back the factories now that we, in previous incarnations, shipped abroad. And that's a good thing. You know, it gives us higher wages, as we talked about. And that's a good thing because it rebuilds the middle class in the U.S. and makes us a stable country instead of this batshit crazy country that we are right now. But it's a very expensive process. You know, if you leave a factory in China where the workers are making $4 an hour, you bring that factory back here where people are making $30 an hour, all of a sudden the price of what you're selling is going to go up. So that alone, the onshoring and the friendshoring process that we're in right now, is probably good for 3 or 4 or 5% inflation on top of everything else going forward. So that's a real thing. And it's a dilemma for the Fed because it doesn't want to slow down the process of us bringing factories back by crashing the economy, but neither can it let inflation be 4 or 5 or 6% going forward because that's destabilizing. So it's not clear how we play this, but it's definitely clear that supply chain issues are part of the fact that inflation is stickier than it was.
Labor shortages, high wage demands, is that going to increase the demand for more AI to replace humans?
Absolutely. You know, and anytime wages go up, the incentive to automate becomes more intense. You know, it's funny. We got two sets of economists out there. One set says, says, oh no, demographics are a disaster. We're not going to have enough young people to do the jobs anymore going forward because we're having so few babies. The other group says, well, look at automation. It's going to wipe out all the jobs. You know, there won't be any jobs for anybody, and just a handful of people will own the robots, and they'll be the rich people, and everybody else will be dirt poor. And see, those are mutually exclusive scenarios, right? You can't have one. You can't have both at the same time. You can only have one or the other. So we'll have to see. You know, it's possible we end up with some kind of a middle ground where we're having fewer babies, we've got fewer young people, but automation takes a lot of the jobs. So basically the jobs get done, you know, and that would be the best way for it to play out. And we'll see. You know, very seldom do we get the best scenario, but maybe this time.
The European Union is talking about a robot tax. If a automation system replaces a worker, the company has to pay a tax to support the displaced worker.
Well, some variation of that will have to happen if that's the way it goes, because if automation concentrates wealth and income even more than it is today, then you know, there's nobody left to pay the taxes except the guys that own the robots, right? So somehow, some way, there has to be a transfer, an even bigger transfer than we've got now. We've got quite a big transfer of income going on now, where people pay taxes and it goes to pay Social Security and Medicare to today's retirees. Well, we'd need something much bigger than that. If automation plays out in the you know, in the scenario in which automation gets rid of most jobs, then you're going to have something like a UBI, Universal Basic Income, that everybody just gets automatically. And they live on that if they can't find any other work. And, you know, obviously they won't live well, but they'll live. You know, that's not an ideal solution, but it might be the one we end up with.
John, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Well, volatility, Jim, is what you want to look out for going forward, because you know, interest rates, according to the Fed, might go up one more time this year and might stay at that level through 2024. That's a debilitating level of interest rates. It's going to cause all kinds of crazy things to happen. It'll probably crash the stock and the housing market, so we should be aware of that. You know, it might be a good time to short some stuff. It definitely is a good time to have some cash on hand, you know. So just be defensive in a time of extreme volatility, unless you're a sophisticated investor and you want to do volatility spreads in the option market or something like that. But this would be one of the times when that works really well.
John, where can people follow you?
I'm on Substack, rubino.substack.com, and I mostly focus on actionable stuff. In other words, what can we do about all the crazy things that are coming our way?
Instead of just being a helpless spectator.
Well, or just a, you know, whiny gloom and doomer who's talking about all the bad things going on in the world. You know, I think it's psychologically more healthy to focus on the things you can do to protect yourself and to get rich. When crazy times are coming, and it makes those crazy times seem less terrifying and makes it easier to get up in the morning.
John, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim. See ya.
My guest has been John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Victor Adair, and John Rubino. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.